hands. After a few minutes, he started coughing and skated to the edge of the pond. "It's cold standing here," he said. "Colder than the rinks." "And darker," I said. He nodded. "So were you a fan?" he asked. "Because I was local, or did you really like my skating?" "Both," I said. "Mrs. Daly was always telling us about you. I love how you skate. Your line, your extension. You were more than jumps. I really believed you could win at the Olympics." "I was a long shot," he said. "But I was aiming for gold." "Is Mrs. Daly all right?" I asked. "I haven't seen her since all this happened." "She and her husband left here in August," Brandon said. "They have a daughter in Texas." "How about all the other skaters?" I asked. "Do you know how they are?" He shook his head. "The ones on tour with me were okay when we split up," he said. "They were desperate to get home. I wasn't quite so desperate, but after a while I couldn't figure out any other place to go, so I made it back here. My father cried when he saw me. My mother always cries, but it was the first time I'd ever seen my father cry. I guess that means something." "I've stopped crying," I said. "My best friend died, and I just got mad." "Come on," Brandon said. "Skate." So I did. It was a nothing skate, just stroking and a two-footed waltz jump and a ridiculous Ina Bauer. When I finished, I didn't feel mad anymore. "Come back tomorrow?" he asked. I'd forgotten how much fun it is to skate with somebody. "I'll try," I said, unlacing my skates and putting my shoes back on. "Thank you." "Thank you," he said. He went back on the ice, and when I left him, he was stroking around the pond, beautiful and alone. Chapter 15. October 26th. Mom tripped over her shoes yesterday morning, by the side of her mattress. She fell at a funny angle and hurt her ankle again. She wrapped it back up with the ace bandage and said she wasn't going to baby herself this time. If she limped for the rest of her life, so be it. But she couldn't even manage to stand. She told Matt that she'd be fine in the kitchen, that there was no reason to move her back into the sunroom and have the wood stove going just for her, but he insisted. But since the pipes would freeze if we didn't keep the heat on, it was 12 degrees this afternoon. I guess Indian summer was pretty short this year. He and Mom decided the rest of us would keep sleeping where we had been. Some of this I'm okay with. I wouldn't have been crazy about doing the laundry with Mom lying on the mattress in the kitchen. It's hard enough to maneuver around when she's in the other room. But at least this way, if I step on a mattress, I don't have to worry that I'm stepping on her. And I won't have any more housework to do. Mom gave up dusting and sweeping when we moved downstairs. The dining room is a lost cause, and it was too hard for her to get around the mattresses on the living room floor. So the only real problem is that it's up to me to make sure the fire doesn't go out in the wood stove. It's the only source of heat in the sunroom, so it has to keep burning all night. I wake up a lot anyway. I just have to put a log or two on the fire every time I do. I made Mom promise if she woke up cold, she'd yell to get me up, but I don't know if she really will. Matt says he wakes up too, and he'll check on it, which means he'll walk through the kitchen to get there and probably wake me up anyway. It would make sense for me to sleep in the sunroom, but the idea of even a little bit of privacy is so thrilling to me, I can't bear to give it up. Mom and I have been alternating visiting Mrs. Nesbitt, so I'll just take over her shift. If nothing else, that'll give me an excuse to leave the house. But no more skating. There's no way I could leave Mom to go to the pond and skate. It doesn't matter. I spent a lot of yesterday trying to decide if it all really happened or if I just made it up. Me, skating with Brandon Ehrlich. Us, actually talking? Him being so nice. I've made up stranger stuff than that. He was probably just being nice when he asked me to come back. He probably prefers skating by himself rather than being stuck with some dumb fangirl klutz. Mom was upset that I wouldn't be able to go skating. She told me she'd be fine, but of course I couldn't leave her like that. When you're better, I'll go skating again, I told her. The pond isn't going to thaw out anytime soon. I'm afraid not, she said. But I feel so bad for you. You were finally doing something you enjoyed, and now I've screwed things up again. I thought she was going to cry, but she didn't. I guess none of us is crying anymore, October 28th. Peter came by unexpectedly. Well, all visits are unexpected these days, so what I mean is he wasn't summoned, and checked out Mom's ankle. He agreed it wasn't broken, but he said this sprain is worse than the last one, and Mom needs to stay off her feet for at least 2 weeks, maybe more. He also thought Mom might have broken one of her toes, but he said there's nothing that can be done about it, so why even worry? Which is pretty funny coming from Peter. There doesn't seem much point to sleeping all night, since I have to check the fire regularly, so I'm grabbing naps day and night. I sleep for 2 to 3 hours, then wake up and do whatever needs to be done, and then go back to sleep. Actually, the smartest time for me to sleep would be in the early evening, when Matt and John are home and can tend the fire. But that's the time I most want to be awake. Sometimes I nod off anyway. It's driving Mom crazy that she can't do anything, but there's not much any of us can do about that. Oh, and I have an exciting new job as well. Mom can't make it to the bathroom, and Matt located a bedpan in the attic, and I get to clean it. I keep threatening to put kitty litter in it. It's funny. Mom sprained her ankle a few weeks ago, and things were okay. It was a good time. Not that much has changed since then, but it certainly isn't a good time. October 29th. I told Mrs. Nesbitt about Peter's visit and what he'd said about Mom. I didn't leave any of it out, including the part where Peter said that even after Mom could walk around the house, she wasn't to think about walking outside. "I guess you're stuck with me for a while," I said. Mrs. Nesbitt surprised me. "Good," she said. "It's better that way." I thought it had taken courage to tell Mrs. Nesbitt about Mom's ankle. It took a lot more courage to ask her why it was better that way. "I didn't want your mother to find me dead," Mrs. Nesbitt said. "It won't be fun for you either, but you're younger and I mean less to you." "Mrs. Nesbitt," I said. She gave me one of those looks that used to terrify me when I was very little. "This is no time for make-believe," she said. "I could be dead tomorrow. We need to talk honestly. No point beating around the bush." "I don't want you to die," I said. "I appreciate that," she said. "Now, when I do die and you find me, here are the important things. First of all, do whatever you want with my body, whatever is easiest. Peter dropped by to visit me after he left your house, and he told me that a dozen or more people are dying every day around here. I'm no better than any of them, and probably a fair amount worse than some. Peter says the hospital is still taking bodies, so if that's what works for you, it'll be fine for me. Never liked the idea of burial anyway. Always preferred cremation. My husband's ashes are scattered in the Atlantic somewhere, so it's not like our graves would be side by side." "All right," I said. "If I find your body, I'll tell Matt and he'll get you to the hospital." "Good," she said. "Now, after I'm gone, go through the house and take everything you can possibly use. Don't worry about leaving things for my heirs. I haven't heard from my son or his family since May, so I have to assume they won't be needing my things. If any of them show up at your doorstep and you still have something of mine, give it to them. But don't worry about it. Go through the whole house, attic to cellar. My car has some gas in it, so you can put all my things in it and drive back to your place. Don't be bashful. I won't be needing anything, and the more you have, the better your chances. This is going to be a long and terrible winter, and I'd be very angry if I thought you left something behind that could have helped you get through it." "Thank you," I said. "After I die, wrap me up in a sheet," she said. "Don't waste a blanket on it. And even if someone in my family comes back, I want your mother to have my diamond pendant and you to have my ruby brooch. Those are my gifts for the two of you, and don't you forget it. Matt's to have the painting of the sailboats, because he always liked that when he was little, and Johnny should have the landscape in the dining room. I don't know if he likes it or not, but he's entitled to something, and that's a good piece. You probably can't use any of my furniture, but you might want to take it for firewood." "You have antiques," I said. "We couldn't burn them." "Speaking of burning things, I burned all my letters and diaries," she said. "Not that there was a single interesting word in any of them, but I didn't want you to be tempted, so they're all gone. I kept the albums, though. Your mother might get a kick going through them, seeing the old pictures of her family. You have all that?" I nodded. "Good," she said. Don't tell your mother any of this until after I'm gone. She has enough to worry about. But when I've died, you be sure to tell your mother I loved her like a daughter, and all of you like grandchildren. Tell her I'm just as glad she didn't see me at the end, and she should never feel guilty that she couldn't come by for one last visit. We love you, I said. We all love you so much.
I should think so, she said. Now, tell me, have you started your schoolwork yet?
Of course I haven't, but I recognized a change of subject and went along with it.
When I got home, I put wood in the stove and curled up for a nap. It was easier sleeping, or pretending to sleep, than trying to make small talk with Mom about Mrs. Nesbit. I've never really thought about what it would be like to be an old woman. Of course, nowadays, I'm not sure I'll live long enough to be any kind of a woman. But I hope, when I get closer to death, however old I might be, that I can face it with courage and good sense the way Mrs. Nesbit does. I hope that's a lesson I've truly learned. November 1st. Matt hovered around the house all morning, which was unusual. He's been even more obsessive about chopping wood ever since Mom moved back into the sunroom. I know it's because we're using up firewood earlier than planned, but it still annoys me just a little. I'd like him to stay indoors occasionally and clean the bedpan. Sometime this afternoon, I could hear the sound of a car in our driveway. Matt bolted outside, and the next thing I knew, he, John, and a couple of guys I didn't recognize were moving sheets of plywood out of a pickup truck and into the sunroom. Mom watched, but she didn't say anything, so I guess she knew about it. After the guys left, Matt and John spent the rest of the day covering the windows in the sunroom with the plywood. When the house was first built, the sunroom didn't exist. It was just a back porch, and windows in the kitchen and dining room looked out on it. But when the porch was enclosed, the spaces stayed where the kitchen and dining room windows were, even though the actual windows were removed. That's where a lot of the light in both rooms comes from, since the sunroom has skylights and three walls of windows, plus the outside door, of course. Matt blocked off the kitchen sunroom window with the plywood, and put a sheet of plywood in front of the dining room sunroom window so it can be pushed aside for easier access to the firewood. Now, the only natural light in the sunroom comes from the skylights. Not that there's been much sunlight lately, but the room is a lot darker. Then, just in case I wasn't miserable enough, they blocked off the window over the kitchen sink. So now, the only natural light in the kitchen is what comes from the skylights in the sunroom through the kitchen sunroom door. In other words, just about none. Are you blocking off the living room windows too? I asked.
No reason to, Matt said.
Once we stop using heat, we'll close off the living room. But we still might use the kitchen.
I'm so angry I could scream. For starters, I'm sure Matt got the plywood from the gang I saw in town, and I hate that he didn't tell me he was going to.
No discussion. He knew what was best, and he just went ahead and did it.
Okay, he talked to Mom about it, but I wasn't consulted.
And he doesn't understand what it's like to be cooped up in this house all day long. The only time I get out is when I visit Mrs. Nesbit, and that's just a short walk there and back. I know Matt and John have it harder than me. Matt eats so little and he's doing physical work. When he comes in, he's exhausted. The other day he fell asleep during supper. But he didn't have to cover the kitchen window. Not yet, anyway. He could have waited until we ran out of oil. He didn't care what it would mean to me. He never even asked. I'd move into Mrs. Nesbit's, but I can't leave Mom. Sometimes I think about how things used to be. I'd never been any place, not really. Florida once, and Boston, and New York City, and Washington, and Montreal, and that was it. I'd dream of Paris, of London, of Tokyo. I wanted to go to South America, to Africa. I always assumed I could someday. But my world keeps getting smaller and smaller. No school, no pond, no town, no bedroom. Now, I don't even have the view out the windows. I feel myself shriveling along with my world, getting smaller and harder. I'm turning into a rock. And in some ways that's good, because rocks last forever. But if this is how I'm going to last forever, then I don't want to. November 5th. I was in the kitchen washing out Mom's bedpan when the water stopped running. I turned on the faucets in the downstairs bathroom and nothing came out. I went upstairs and checked that bathroom. Nothing. I waited until Matt came in before telling him. For a moment, he got mad at me.
"You should have told me right away," he yelled. "If the pipes are frozen, I might have been able to do something."
"But I know it's not because the pipes are frozen. It's because the wells run dry. We haven't had any rain since July. No matter how careful we've been with water, it was bound to run out eventually." Matt and I walked over to the well to check it out. Of course I was right. When we came in, John was sitting with Mom in the sunroom, so we joined them. "How long can we survive without water?" he asked. "It's not that bad," Matt said. "We still have bottled water and soda to drink. No more laundry, I guess. And Miranda will just have to share a bedpan with Mom." He grinned like that was some kind of joke. "We don't have that much bottled water," John said. "What if it never rains again?"
"We'll get some snow before too long," Matt said.
"But in the meantime, we can cut some chunks of ice from Miller's pond. We'll boil it and hope for the best."
"Isn't there someplace else we could get ice?" I asked.
"How about your little friends in the black market?"
"They're not my little friends, and they don't have any water or ice," Matt said. "Or if they do, they're not selling it. If you can think of someplace closer than the pond, great. But that's the best I can come up with."
I thought about Brandon skating on the pond. I told myself it had never really happened, so it didn't matter.
"Since there's no water left, there's no reason to keep the heat on," Matt continued. "We might as well conserve the oil and move into the sunroom."
"No!" I shouted. "I won't!"
"Why not?" John asked, and I could tell he was genuinely surprised.
"It's warm in here. Even with the furnace on, it's cold in the house. Why not move?"
"I spend a lot of time in the kitchen," I said. "Not just sleeping. And it's bad enough now. I'll freeze to death if we turn the heat off. Is that what you want? You want me to freeze to death?"
"You won't be spending any more time in the kitchen," Matt said, "except to get stuff out of the pantry. We don't cook in there anymore or eat in there, and now you won't be doing any washing in there.
If something happens to the firewood and we don't have any heating oil left, we'll freeze to death. It's better to keep some in reserve."
"What difference does it make?" I said.
"We're never going to make it through the winter. It's November, and already we're out of water, and the temperature is below zero, and there's no way of getting more food."
"We're dying in increments, Matt. You know that. We all know that."
"Maybe we are," Mom said, and I was almost startled to hear her speak. She's been talking a lot less since she hurt her ankle again, and she's really cut down on her rah-rah speeches.
"But as long as we don't know what the future is going to bring us, we owe it to ourselves to keep living. Things could get better. Somewhere, people are working on solutions to all this. They have to be. It's what people do. And our solution is to stay alive one day at a time.
Everyone dies in increments, Miranda. Every day, we are one day closer to death. But there's no reason to rush into it.
I intend to stay alive as long as I possibly can, and I expect the same from you. The only sensible thing to do is for all of us to stay in the sunroom."
"Not tonight," I said.
"Please, not tonight."
"Tomorrow morning," Mom said. "We'll bring the mattresses in then."
"It'll be okay," Matt said to me. "In some ways, it'll be better. You won't be the only one responsible for the fire. We can take turns stoking it. You'll sleep better."
"Yeah," John said. "You'll have it easy, Miranda. You won't even have any housework to do."
So tonight is my last night alone. And my world has gotten even smaller.
Chapter 16. November 7th. Mrs. Nesbit died. I don't know when, but she was in bed, and I like to think she died in her sleep. Her eyes were closed, and she looked peaceful. I kissed her cheek and covered her face with her top sheet. I sat silently by her side for a while, mostly to see if I was going to cry. But I didn't, and I knew I couldn't sit there forever, no matter how peaceful it was. I knew she wanted us to have everything, but I made a point of taking out her diamond pendant and ruby brooch first. Then I went downstairs and took the two paintings off the wall she wanted Matt and Johnny to have.
I piled all the things on the kitchen table and tried to decide what to look at next. What I really wanted to do was go through her kitchen cabinets and see what food she had left, but the very thought of it made me excited, and that didn't seem like the proper way to feel. It made me feel like a cannibal. So I found a flashlight and started with the attic. I didn't know what I was going to find there, but Mrs. Nesbit had told me to go from the attic to the cellar, and I had no desire to go to the cellar. The attic was filled with boxes and trunks. It was ice cold in there, and I knew I didn't have the energy to go through every single one of them, so I hopped from box to box. There were lots of old clothes, which I didn't think would be any help to us. There were also boxes of papers, accounts from Mr. Nesbit's business. I opened a box called Bobby's Things and found something great in there. Most of the stuff was from school, papers he'd written and the letters he'd gotten from being on the school basketball team. But toward the bottom, I found a shoebox filled with old baseball cards. I thought about how John hadn't gotten a birthday present, and I clutched that shoebox. I'd surprise him with it at Christmas, or before Christmas if I don't think we'll make it that long. I went downstairs then and walked through the bedrooms and looked in the closets. There were clean towels and washcloths that Mrs. Nesbit must not have used. Clean sheets and blankets and quilts. No matter how warm we might be in the sunroom, extra blankets seemed like a good idea. There were boxes of tissues I knew we could use, and rolls of toilet paper, aspirin and painkillers, cold remedies. I took a clean pillowcase and started putting stuff in there, starting with the baseball cards. I didn't put any of the blankets in there, but I did throw in some of the towels and washcloths. There really wasn't any logic to what I put in and what I left out. I'd be sending Matt over to fill the car, and he could pick up anything I forgot to take. Then I allowed myself to go to the kitchen. I opened the cabinets, and I saw cans of soup and vegetables and tuna and chicken, all the stuff we'd been eating for months now. There wasn't enough for us to eat 3 meals a day, but every can would keep us alive a little bit longer. I knew, without her ever telling me, that Mrs. Nesbit had been going hungry so we could have the food. I thanked her silently and kept looking. In the back of one of the cabinets, I found a box of chocolates, unopened, with a Happy Mother's Day card attached. Mrs. Nesbit never was one for chocolate. He would have thought her son knew that. I took the chocolate and put it in the bottom of the pillowcase, along with the baseball cards. I couldn't decide whether to give it to Mom at Christmas or on her birthday. Then I realized there was a funny noise in back of me. I turned around and saw the kitchen faucet was dripping. I grabbed a pot and put it under the faucet and turned it on. Actual water poured out. Mrs. Nesbit's well hadn't run dry. There was only one of her, and she hadn't used up all her water. Her insistence on keeping the heat on had prevented the pipes from freezing. I grabbed a lot of the cans and an unopened box of raisins and rammed them into the pillowcase. Then I went through the entire house, top to bottom, looking for containers for the water. Everything I found that could possibly hold water, bottles and jugs and canisters and barrels, I dragged into the kitchen. I filled them all just for the joy of hearing running water. I was tempted to pour myself a glass of water and drink it, but even though the water was probably clean, I knew it should be boiled first. But then I thought to look in Mrs. Nesbit's refrigerator. Sure enough, she'd been using it for storage space, and there was an untouched six-pack of bottled water. I let myself drink one. It was all I could do to keep from gulping it down in three giant swallows, but I sipped it instead, like a fine wine. It's funny. All the food there, and I wasn't tempted by any of it, but I couldn't resist the water. Then, just because I could, I took a washcloth, dampened it with sink water, and washed my face and hands. Soon I took off all my clothes and gave myself a sponge bath. The water was cold, and the kitchen wasn't much warmer, but it was glorious feeling clean again. I got back into my dirty clothes and slipped the 5 bottles of drinking water into what I was starting to think of as my Santa bag, and realized I couldn't carry much more. There was no way I could manage to take the paintings, but I did put the 2 pieces of jewelry in my pants pocket. I heaved the bag over my shoulder and went out the kitchen door. I've been alternating between walking on the road and through the backwoods to get to Mrs. Nesbit's, so I knew no one would think it suspicious if they didn't see me on the road. I only hoped no one would see me in the woods, since if they saw the Santa bag, they'd know right away that I'd been taking things from Mrs. Nesbit's house. If anyone got there before Matt, We'd lose the food, the water, everything. I walked as fast as I could, cursing myself for having filled the pillowcase with so much stuff. It was one of my non-brunch days, and I was hungry. The water gurgled in my stomach. I spotted Matt and John chopping away. They'd cut firewood for Mrs. Nesbitt, I remembered. More stuff for them to take from her house. For a moment, I was torn between speaking to them while I was still holding on to the bag, or going to the house to drop the bag off and then going to talk to them. But I'd have to tell Mom if she saw me carrying stuff in, and I was just as happy to postpone that. So I positioned myself with the bag behind a tree, just in case someone could see me talking to Matt and John.
"Mrs. Nesbitt died," I whispered. "She told me a few days ago to take everything we could use. She still has running water. Her car has a little gas in it."
"Where is she?" Johnny asked.
"She's in her bed," I said. "Peter told her the hospital was taking bodies, and she said we should bring her there if that was easiest for us. We had a long talk about things a few days ago."
"Do I have to do that?" Johnny asked. "Do I have to go in?"
"No," Matt said. "But you have to help us bring stuff over. There's a wheelbarrow in her garage. We can fill it with firewood for you to take back here. Miranda, would you mind going back in?"
"No, of course not," I said.
"Okay then," he said. "We'll strip the house. Do you have any idea how to drive?"
"The gas pedal makes it go, and the brake makes it stop," I said.
Matt grinned.
"You'll be fine," he said.
"We'll drive the van there, and we'll bring all our empty bottles and jugs so we can fill them with water. We'll load things up, and I'll drive the van back, and you'll drive Mrs. Nesbitt's car. Then I'll go back and get Mrs. Nesbitt and take her to the hospital. By the time I get back, the house will be ransacked, but we'll have gotten everything we can out of there. When you go back for Mrs. Nesbitt, fill the car up again," I said. "Honestly, she wouldn't mind."
"Okay," Matt said.
"Take the bag in and tell Mom. John, come with me. Let's get water containers." So we all went back to the house. Mom was sitting on her mattress, staring at the fire. She heard me come in, and then she saw the pillowcase.
"Where did you get that?" she asked.
"It's Mrs. Nesbitt's," I said.
"Mom, I'm sorry."
It took her a moment to realize what I was saying. Then she did and took a deep breath.
"Was it peaceful?" she asked.
"Could you tell?"
"She died in her sleep," I said. "Just the way she wanted."
"Well, that's the best we can hope for," Mom said. When we got to Mrs. Nesbitt's, Johnny stayed outside and loaded the wheelbarrow with wood. Matt and I went inside. Matt filled all the containers we'd brought with water, and I packed up the blankets and towels and sheets and food and the photo albums and the two paintings. While we were in the kitchen, John raced in. He'd found two barrels in the garage and a couple of plastic recycling bins and a heavy garbage pail. The garbage pail weighed so much when we filled it with water that it took all three of us to lift it into the van. Johnny and I managed the recycling bins together. We did everything as quietly as we could, but of course if anyone heard the car motor, they'd know something was up. The rule is family first, and Matt said everyone thought of us as Mrs. Nesbitt's family, so we should be okay. But it was still scary until we got both cars loaded and both engines running. Then, of course, I had to drive down the driveway onto the road and up our driveway to the sunroom door. The important thing, I kept telling myself, was not to panic. There were no cars on the road, so I wasn't going to hit anybody. It was more a question of whether I'd hit a tree. I kept my hands locked on the steering wheel and drove about 5 miles an hour. The whole trip couldn't have taken more than 5 minutes, but it felt like an eternity. If I was that nervous driving, I knew I wasn't ready to die. John arrived with the wheelbarrow, which he left in our garage. Then, he and Matt and I unloaded the cars. We put everything in the kitchen to be gone through later. I thought Mom was going to cry when she saw all the water. Matt asked me if I wanted to go back with him and bring Mrs. Nesbitt to the hospital. Before I had a chance to agree, Mom said no. "Miranda's done enough," she said. "Johnny, go with your brother."
"Mom," Johnny said.
"You heard me," Mom said. "You say you want to be treated like an adult? Then behave like one." Miranda said her goodbyes to Mrs. Nesbitt. "Mine too, I'm sure. It's your turn to do so, and I expect that you will."
"Okay," Johnny said.
He sounded so young, I wanted to hug him.
This is going to take a while, Matt said. Don't open the door while we're gone. You should be fine, but don't take any chances.
We'll be safe, Mom said. Be careful. I love you both.
After they left, I made Mom drink one of the bottles of water. Then I sat with her and told her about the conversation I'd had with Mrs. Nesbit. I pulled the pendant out of the Santa bag and handed it to her.
It was her 50th birthday present, Mom said. Her husband gave it to her.
There was a big surprise party, and I think she was genuinely surprised. Bobby brought Sally home for the party, so we all knew it was serious. They got married later that year. She told me to give you her photo albums, I said. I bet there are pictures from the party.
Oh, I'm sure there are, Mom said.
Here, help me with the clasp. I think she'd like to know I'm wearing the pendant. I helped Mom on with it. She's gotten so thin I could see her shoulder blades.
She gave me this brooch, I said, showing it to Mom.
She loved that brooch, Mom said. It was her grandmother's.
Cherish it, Miranda. That's a very special gift.
Then I went back to work. The bottles and jugs got moved to the kitchen. I put the food in the pantry, and then I changed Mom's sheets. I took a pot, filled it with water, and after it had heated up, I helped Mom shampoo her hair. I hid the baseball cards in the chocolate and put everything else away. Matt and John got home around supper time. They had seen Peter, and there was no problem with the hospital taking Mrs. Nesbit. Then we ate tuna and red beans and pineapple chunks, and we toasted the best friend we'll ever have.
November 8th. Mom hobbled her way, which she probably shouldn't have done, into the pantry this afternoon. Matt and Johnny were doing their wood-chopping things. I left Mom alone in the pantry for a while. I'm losing all sense of time. But then I figured I'd better make sure she hadn't fallen. So I went into the pantry and found her sitting on the floor weeping. I put my arm around her shoulder and let her cry. After a while, she calmed down, and then she embraced me. I helped her up, and she leaned on me as we went back to the sunroom. I have never loved Mom as much as I love her now. I almost feel like some of Mrs. Nesbit's love for Mom has seeped into me.
November 10th. Peter came over this afternoon. Each time I see him, he looks 5 years older. He didn't talk much to us. He just lifted Mom off her mattress, blankets and all, and carried her into the living room. They stayed there a long time. Matt and John came in while they were there, and we all whispered so Mom wouldn't be disturbed by the sound of our voices. When they came back into the sunroom, Peter put Mom down so gently on her mattress, I almost wept. There was so much love and kindness in that gesture. Peter told us to take care of Mom and make sure she doesn't try to do too much. We promised we would. I wonder if Dad was ever that gentle with Mom. I wonder if he's that gentle now with Lisa.
November 11th. Veterans Day, a national holiday. Matt stayed home from the post office. I think this is the funniest thing ever.
November 15th. I went to my bedroom to look for cleaner socks, and while I was up there, I decided to weigh myself. I had on a fair number of layers of clothes. Even though we have the wood stove going day and night, the sides of the sunroom don't get too warm, and of course leaving the sunroom to go to the pantry or the kitchen or upstairs is like hiking to the North Pole. You don't just stroll there in a bikini. I had on my underwear and my long johns. Sometimes I remember how upset I was when Mom bought them last spring, and now I thank her over and over, at least in my mind. And jeans, and sweatpants, and two shirts, and a sweatshirt, and a winter coat, and two pairs of socks and shoes. I didn't bother with a scarf, and I kept my gloves in my pocket because I knew I wasn't going to be upstairs too long. For the great weighing in, I took off my shoes and my coat. According to the scale, my clothes and I weigh 96 pounds. I don't think that's too bad. Nobody starves to death at 96 pounds. I weighed 118 last spring. My real concern is how much muscle I've lost. I was in good shape from all the swimming, and now I don't do anything except carry firewood and shiver. I'd like to go back to the pond and do some more skating, but I feel guilty leaving Mom alone. When I left her alone to visit Mrs. Nesbit,
I was doing something for someone else. But skating would just be for me, and I can't justify that. Matt and John are both thin, but they look like they're pure muscle. Mom looks skinny and sickly. She's been eating less than the rest of us for a while now, but she also started out weighing more, so I don't think she's at starvation level either. We have food, but we're so careful with it. Who knows when we'll get any more? Even Peter doesn't bring us any when he visits. Thanksgiving is next week. I wonder if we'll have anything to be thankful for. November 18th. Matt came flying home from the post office today. There was a letter from Dad. The only problem was the letter was sent before the other one. I guess he wrote a letter between the two we'd already gotten. This one was from Ohio. It didn't say much, just that he and Lisa were doing well, and so far they had enough gas and food, and camping out was fun. They met lots of other families who were also going south or west, and he'd even run into someone he'd known in college. Lisa threw in a P.S. to say she could feel the baby move. She was sure it was a boy, but Dad was equally sure it was a girl. It was so strange getting that letter. I couldn't understand why Matt was so happy. It wasn't like there was any new news in it, since we know Dad and Lisa made it farther west than that. But Matt said it means mail is still traveling and is totally unpredictable, so a newer letter from Dad could arrive at any time. Sometimes, I feel like I miss Dad and Sammy and Dan more than I miss Megan and Mrs. Nesbitt. They all deserted me, but I can't blame Megan or Mrs. Nesbitt for not writing. I know I can't blame Dad or Sammy or Dan either. Or I shouldn't blame them, which is more accurate. I have no privacy, but I feel so alone. November 20th. It was minus 10 when I went out with the bedpan. I'm pretty sure that was early afternoon. Matt keeps chopping wood. There's already too much for the dining room, so he started a pile in the living room. I wonder if we'll have any trees left by the time winter ends. If it ends. We still have water, but we ration it. November 24th. Thanksgiving. Even Mom didn't pretend we had anything to be thankful for. November 25th. Matt came home today from the post office with two special treats. One was Peter. The other was a chicken. It wasn't all that much of a chicken, maybe a little bigger than a Cornish hen, but it was dead and plucked and ready for cooking. I guess Matt knew he'd be getting it and had arranged for Peter to join us in our day-after-Thanksgiving feast. There was a moment when I thought about where the chicken had come from and what Matt must have given up for us to have it. But then I decided the hell with it. It was chicken, a real, honest-to-goodness, not-from-a-canned chicken. And I'd be a fool to look a gift chicken in the mouth. No matter what Matt might have given up for the chicken, it would have been worth it for the look in Mom's eyes when she saw it. She looked happier than she has in weeks. Since the only way we can cook is on top of the wood stove, we were kind of limited. But we put the chicken in a pot with a can of chicken broth and salt and pepper and rosemary and tarragon. Just the smell of it was heaven. We made rice and string beans, too. It was wonderful beyond description. I'd forgotten what actual chicken tastes like. I think we each could have eaten the entire chicken, but we shared it very civilly. I had a leg and two bites of thigh. Peter and John broke the wishbone. John won, but it didn't matter, since we all have the same wish. November 26th. I guess the chicken really revitalized Mom, because today she decided we were all wasting our lives and that had to stop. Of course it's true, but it's still pretty funny that Mom felt the need to make a big deal out of it. Have any of you done a bit of schoolwork all fall? She asked. You too, Matt. Have you? Well, of course not. We tried to look shamefaced. Bad us for not doing algebra when the world is coming to an end. I don't care what you study, Mom said. But you have to study something. Pick one subject and work on that. I want to see open school books. I want to see some learning going on here. I absolutely refuse to study French, I said. I'll never go to France. I'll never meet anyone from France. For all we know, there isn't a France anymore. So don't study French, Mom said. Study history.
We may not have a future, but you can't deny we have a past.
That was the first time I ever heard Mom say that about the future.
It shocked any possible fight out of me.
So, I picked history as my subject. John picked algebra, and Matt said he'd help him with it. Matt admitted he'd been wanting to read some philosophy, and Mom said if I wasn't going to use my French textbook, she would. I don't know how long this burst of studying is going to last, but I understand Mom's point. The other night, I dreamed that I found myself in school for a final, and not only hadn't I been to class and didn't know anything, but the school was just the way it had been, and everybody there was normal-looking, and I was dressed in layers of clothes and hadn't washed in days, and everyone stared at me like I was a drop-in from hell. At least now, if it's a history test, I'll have a fighting chance of knowing some of the answers. November 30th. There's nothing like schoolwork to make a person want to play hooky. I told Mom I wanted to go for a walk, and she said, "Well, why don't you? You've been spending entirely too much time indoors." I love her, but I could throttle her. So I layered up and walked over to Mrs. Nesbitt's house. I don't know what I was looking for or what I was expecting to find, but the house had been ransacked since the day she died. That was to be expected. We'd taken everything we could use, but there was stuff like furniture that we didn't need and other people had taken for themselves. It felt funny walking around the empty house. It reminded me of Megan's house when I'd gone there, like the house itself was dead. After I'd walked around a while, I realized what I wanted to do was explore the attic. Maybe that hadn't been gone through, or at least not as thoroughly. And, sure enough, even though all the boxes had been opened and contents pulled out, there was plenty of stuff left in there. And that's when I knew I was there looking for a Christmas present for Matt. John had the baseball cards. Mom had the box of chocolates. But I wanted Matt to have something, too. Most of what was lying around on the floor was old linens, tablecloths and stuff like that. There were piles of old clothes, too, nothing anyone could have found usable. When I'd gone through the attic the first time, it had been crowded with boxes, but everything was neatly packed away. Now it was chaos. Not that it mattered. I looked through piles of things, through boxes that had been gone through but nothing taken out. And finally, I found something I could give Matt. It was a dozen or so different colored pencils from an old color-by-number picture set. The pictures had all been carefully colored in, but their backs were blank, so I decided to take them, too. Back in high school, Matt had done some drawing. I wasn't sure he'd even remember it, but I did, because he did a sketch of me in a much better layback position than I'd ever really managed. Mom had loved it and wanted to hang it up, but it embarrassed me because I knew it wasn't really me, and I threw a tantrum until she gave up on the idea. I guess she kept the picture, but I don't know where she hid it. At some point, Matt's going to stop chopping firewood, and when he does, he can take up art again, to go along with his philosophy studies. I went through the other stuff in the attic, but the pencils were definitely the high point. So I thanked Mrs. Nesbitt and went home. Just to be sneaky, I went in through the front door and took the color-by-number set up to my bedroom before returning to the sunroom. We may not have a chicken for Christmas dinner, but at least there'll be presents. December 1st. For the third straight day, the temperature was above zero this afternoon, so I took Mom's skates and went to the pond. There was no one there. I'm really starting to think that whole Brandon thing was a hallucination. In a funny way, it was better that I was alone, since I never am at home. Mom can definitely hobble around now, so I don't have to hover around her all the time, but it's way too cold in the house to spend much time any place but the sunroom. I skated around the pond, nothing fancy, and incredibly slow. I had to be careful, since there were chunks of ice missing. I guess people have been hacking away at it for water, the way we will once Mrs. Nesbitt's water runs out. The air is so bad, I don't know how Matt and Johnny manage. I'd skate for a few minutes and then start coughing. I probably didn't skate for more than 15 minutes total, but I was exhausted by the time I finished, and it took most of my strength to get back home. Matt, Mom, and I are down to one meal a day, but at least we're eating 7 days a week. And maybe the temperature really is warming up. And that'll make things better. Chapter 17. December 2nd. Fridays, Matt goes to the post office first thing in the morning. Lately, he's been coming home in the early afternoon. Even though the days are all gray, there's still a difference between daytime and night, and it gets dark very early now. Mom, John, and I were in the sunroom, and it must have been before noon because John hadn't gotten anything to eat. We had two oil lamps going, because even in daytime with the fire in the wood stove, we still need two lamps to have enough light to read by. John was the first one to notice. "Does it seem darker to you?" he asked. He was right. It was darker. First we looked at the oil lamps to see if one of them had gone out. Then we looked at the wood stove. Mom tilted her head up. "It's snowing," she said. "The skylights are covered with snow." With the windows covered by plywood, we can't see what's going on outside. But since the only change in the weather for months has been the temperature, there hasn't been much need to see what's happening. The kitchen window is covered with plywood, too, and we can't get to the windows in the dining room, so we all went to the living room to see what was happening. It must have been snowing for an hour or more. It was coming down at a furious pace. As soon as we realized it was snowing, we also realized the wind was blowing. "It's a blizzard," John said. "We don't know that," Mom said. "The snow could stop in a minute." I couldn't wait. I grabbed my coat and ran outside. I would have done the same for rain or sunlight. It was something different, and I had to experience it. John and Mom followed me. "The snow looks weird," John said. "It's not quite white," Mom said. That was it. It wasn't dark gray like the piles of plowed snow in March, but it wasn't pure white either. Like everything else these days, it was dingy. "I wish Matt were home," Mom said, and for a moment I thought she meant that she wished she could share the moment with him, the excitement of snow, but then I realized she was worried about him getting home. The post office is about 4 miles from here, which isn't that far if you're biking, but could take a long time to walk, especially in blizzard conditions. "You want me to go get him?" John asked. "No," Mom said. "He's probably on his way home now, and it's not like he'll get lost. I'd just feel better if he were home." "One good thing," I said. "If there's any kind of accumulation, we'll have a water supply." Mom nodded. "Johnny, get the barrels and the garbage cans and put them outside," she said. "We can collect snow in them." John and I took everything that could hold snow and put them by the side of the house. By the time we had the last recycling bin out there, the garbage can already had an inch of snow in it. John was right. It was a blizzard. We went back in, but none of us could concentrate on our books. We kept our coats on and sat in the living room, watching the snow fall and waiting for Matt's return. At some point, John made himself some lunch. While he was in the sunroom, I asked Mom if I should go get Matt. "No," she said sharply. "I can't risk losing two of you." I felt like she'd punched me. Matt couldn't possibly be lost. We couldn't survive without him. Mom didn't say anything after that, and I knew to keep my mouth shut. Finally, she went back to the sunroom, and when she did, I went outside and walked toward the road, just to see what conditions were like. The wind was so fierce it came close to knocking me over. The snow was falling almost sideways, and I couldn't see more than a few feet ahead. I barely made it to the road, but when I got there, I couldn't see anything anyway. Matt could have been 20 feet down the road, and I wouldn't have known. Mom was right. I couldn't possibly have made it to town. I could only hope Matt could make the long walk, and that he'd known enough to leave once the snow had begun falling. I went back in and made up some nonsense about going outside to check on the snow collection system. If Mom suspected differently, she didn't say anything. We went back and forth between the sunroom and the living room. Mom went out just past the front door and stood there for a few minutes until I made her come in. I could see how excited John was, the way a kid is when it snows. It was killing him to suppress his excitement. He was killing Mom to suppress her fear. And it was killing me to see both of them trying to hide their feelings. As the day progressed, the sky grew darker and the wind stronger. "I really think I should go find Matt," John said. "I could take one of the oil lamps." "Maybe he should, Mom," I said. At this point, John is stronger than me, and a lot stronger than Mom. He might even be stronger than Matt, just because he's been eating more. If Matt needed help, John was the only one of us who could give it to him. No, Mom said. For all we know, Matt is staying in town with a friend to wait the storm out. But I knew Matt wouldn't do that. He'd come home, or at least he'd try to. He'd be as worried about us as we were about him. Mom, I really think John should go out, I said. Just a little way down the road, but with a lamp. It's getting so dark, Matt could go right past our drive and not realize it. I could see how much Mom hated the idea. I decided to try a different approach. How about if I go out first, I said. And then, in a few minutes, John could take over for me, and then I could take over for him. We'd rotate, and that way neither one of us could get into any trouble. Yeah, Mom, John said. I'll go first. Send Miranda out in a few minutes. All right, Mom said. 15 minutes, and then I'll send Miranda out. John looked really excited, and in a funny way, I didn't blame him. Mom made sure he was thoroughly bundled up, coat and gloves and scarves and boots. She told him not to go too far and to hold the lamp as high as he could to give Matt a beacon. I waited alongside Mom. We didn't say anything. I didn't dare, and Mom was way too wound up to make small talk. Finally, she gestured to me to get ready. I hope this isn't a mistake, she said. We'll be fine, I said. I bet I'll bring Matt home with me. But by the time I reached the driveway, I wasn't even sure I'd make it to where John was. It didn't seem to matter how many layers of clothes I had on. The wind was so fierce it cut right through everything. I especially felt it on my face. I put the scarf over my mouth and nose, but even so, my face burned with the cold. The snow and the darkness made it impossible for me to see anything except what the lamp illuminated. I stumbled several times, and the wind blew me over twice. The snow seeped through my pants, and even my long johns grew cold and wet. At one point, I pulled the scarf away from my mouth so I could gulp air, but I fell into the snow and swallowed a mouthful, which got me coughing. I wanted to give up and go back to the sunroom, to the wood stove, but John was out there waiting for me to relieve him. My idea. My big, bright idea. I have no idea how long it took me to get to John. He was jumping up and down, the light swinging wildly. "You stay warmer that way," he told me. I nodded and told him to go back to the house. I gestured toward where I remembered the house to be. "Tell Mom I'm fine," I said, even though we both knew it was a lie. "I'll be back in a few minutes," he said. I watched as he began trudging back. But in a minute or two, I couldn't see him anymore, even though I knew he wasn't very far away. As I stood out there, I began laughing at myself, at how desperate I'd been to be alone. Now, I was as alone as any human being could be, and all I wanted was to be back in the sunroom, with Matt and Johnny and Mom and Horton all taking up space. I knew I'd be okay as long as I stayed put. I wasn't going to get lost, and Mom would see to it I wasn't out long enough to freeze to death or even to get frostbite. The only one of us in danger was Matt. But with the wind whipping around and the snow blinding me, and my entire body freezing from the cold and the damp, it was hard to feel safe and secure. In addition to everything else, I was hungry. I'm always hungry except right after supper, but I was hungry the way I get right before supper, so I figured it must be around 5. I realized John was right about moving around, so I jogged in place. I was doing okay until a gust of wind caught me off guard, and I fell into the snow and the oil lamp went out. It took all my strength, physical and emotional, to keep from hysteria. I told myself I'd be okay, that John would find me, that Matt would get home, that the lamp could be relit, that everything was going to be fine. But for a moment there, I felt as though I'd been thrown into a snow globe by some powerful giant, that I was a prisoner and would never be free. I felt as though the world really was coming to an end, and even if Matt made it home, we would all die anyway. There was no point getting off the ground. I sat there, holding on to the useless lamp, waiting for Johnny, waiting for Matt, waiting for the world to finally say, "That's enough, I quit." Miranda? Was it Matt? Was it the wind? Was it a hallucination? I honestly didn't know. Miranda! Matt, I said, struggling to get up. Matt, is that really you?
"What are you doing here?" he asked. And the question was so dumb but so reasonable, I burst out laughing. "I'm rescuing you," I said, gasping, which only made me laugh louder. "Well, thank you," Matt said. I think he laughed then also, but the wind and my madness made it hard for me to tell. "Come on," he said, reaching down to pull me up. "Let's go home." We began walking against the wind toward the drive. Matt walked his bike on one side and held on to me on the other. At one point, the wind blew me down, and I pushed him down, and he pushed the bike down. It took us a moment to get back upright, and by the time we could see John's oil lamp bobbing in the distance. There was no point calling out to John, but we used the lamp as a guide and slowly made our way toward it. When we reached John, he hugged Matt so hard I thought he'd drop the lamp and we'd all be there in total darkness. But the lamp stayed lit, and we forged our way back to the house. We went in through the front door, and when we did, Matt called out, "We're home!" Mom came racing as fast as she could toward us. Of course, she hugged Matt first, but then she embraced me like she'd been as afraid for me as she had been for him. Mom made all of us dry off completely and change all our clothes, and then we sat by the wood stove to defrost. All our faces were red, but Matt swore he was okay and not frostbitten. "I would have gotten home sooner, but I didn't want to leave my bike," he said as we sat by the fire. He was just Henry and me at the post office, and for a while we didn't realize it was snowing. Finally, someone came in and told us it had been snowing for a couple of hours and we'd better get home right away. I would have gone with Henry, but he lives nearly as far from the post office as we do, only in a completely different direction, so that didn't make any sense. I was afraid if I left the bike I'd never see it again. You know how things are. Besides, I didn't know if it was going to keep snowing or if it was just a squall. I hoped I'd be able to bike some of the way home, but that was impossible. "You're not going back to the post office," Mom said. "I won't have it." "We'll talk about that next Friday," Matt said. "In the meantime, I'm not going anywhere." At first, I thought Mom was going to put up a fight, but then she just sighed. "I'm hungry," John said. "Isn't it supper time?" "I'll make some soup," Mom said. "I think we could all use some." We had soup first, and then macaroni with marinara sauce. A two-course meal, proof that this was a special event day. We spent the evening going to the front door and peering out at the snow with a flashlight. I'm going to go back there once I finish writing this, and then I'll go to sleep. I don't know if I want it to snow all night long, or if I want it to stop. If it snows, that's more water for us. But there's something frightening about this storm, even though we are all safe at home. It doesn't matter. I can't do anything about it. It'll snow, or it won't, no matter what I want. I just want this day to be over with. December 3rd. It snowed all night, and it snowed all day. The recycling bins are full of snow, so John and Matt brought them in, and we moved the snow into bottles and jars. Then we put the bins back out. The garbage can was half full of snow. We figure there's been close to 2 feet of snow, and it doesn't look like it's letting up any. "We'll be okay for water now," I said, just to make sure. "The snow will last outside for a long time, so we can just bring it in and boil it when we need water. Right?" "I don't see why not," Matt said. "I don't think we'll worry about water for a while. Besides, maybe it will snow again." "Thanks, but no thanks," Mom said. "It doesn't have to be a blizzard," Matt said, "but a few inches now and again could come in handy." "And we're okay for wood?" I asked. I was in the mood for reassurance. "We should be fine," Matt said. I've decided to believe him. It's not like we can go to the wooden water store if we need any. Now that I think about it, I'm not sure we can go anywhere. The roads won't be plowed, and I doubt anyone is going to shovel 4 miles of snow. It's a good thing we still like each other. December 4th. When we got up this morning, we found it had stopped snowing during the night. We couldn't see anything from the sunroom, which is really dark from the snow covering the skylights, but we went first to the living room and then to the front door and checked things out. Because of the wind, the snow had drifted around. There were some stretches of land that hardly had any snow at all, and other places where the snow was close to 5 feet high.
I've never seen snow that high, and I couldn't decide whether to be excited or scared. We went back into the house. Mom took some of last night's snow and made us hot cocoa.